I'm good. So I hope I don't need a microphone. I think everyone can hear me. I'm used to talking in front of classrooms. So we spent a lot of our time working on the Lux Dark Matter experiment, but it's been a while, and I thought I would talk a little bit about the other side of the research that we're doing, which is going on at somewhat lower level, but may increase in future years. So this has to do with a long baseline experiment to Dussel. And this actually shows the actual mine in South Dakota where this is at. This is some of us working here. Hitoshi Murayama standing over there, just looking at the camera. So basically, why would you want to do that? There's already an experiment going to Minnesota. There's already an experiment in Japan. What's different about this one? Well, just to sort of back up a bit to remind you, especially the students in the audience, that we know that neutrinos are mixed, and we know that, for instance, the flavor eigenstates are mixed with the mass eigenstates by a mixing matrix, similar in some respects to the Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix that got the Nobel Prize today, but a different matrix, but similar. And so to actually describe this mixing, you need three angles, just like you need three angles for any rotation. But there's also one phase, which has to do with CP violation, and two sort of Majorana phases that I'm not going to cover today. And this matrix can be parameterized, as I've shown here, divided up into three parts. And this C23 refers to cosine of the angle 2-3, which is one of the three angles. There's a 2-3, there's a 1-3, and there's a 1-2. So it's basically three rotations. And I put the phase in this matrix, and I've ignored the Majorana phases. And the reason that's nice to divide up is this one is sort of addressed by the atmospheric, so-called atmospheric neutrinos, and the neutrinos that Minos is looking at. This is an oscillation that has to do with reactor and the solar neutrinos. So the difference is, from 10 years ago, is that we actually have numbers to put in this matrix now. And so we know that these angles are not exactly this, but pretty close. And so when I put these numbers in, you actually get something that looks quite a bit different than a unit matrix. Okay, so the only unknown that we still really have no idea, except for a limit, is this angle theta 1-3. And of course, and we don't know anything about the CP phase that's shown there. So, but we do know that theta 1-3 is less than 13 degrees. And based on that, you'll find out that these terms are quite small compared to the other ones. And so in the end, the matrix sort of looks like this. It really doesn't look very much like a unit matrix, and it has one unknown element up here, which has theta 1-3 and the CP violation phase. So that element UE3 is 100% sensitive to the mixing angle. So we also don't know some other things about neutrinos. We don't know the mass ordering. The neutrino oscillations tells you the differences between the squares of the masses of the states, but it doesn't tell you what order they're in. There's no sign. And so, for instance, we don't know if the neutrino masses are ordered like 1, 2, 3 or 1, 2, 3. Both of these are completely consistent with the data. We do know that 2 is greater than 1 because of the way that the solar neutrinos come out from the sun and penetrate through the Earth. Okay, there's something called a matter effect, and we can actually tell the sign that way. But we don't know which one is right, the so-called normal or inverted hierarchy. We also don't know if neutrinos violate CP. We don't know the value of that CP violating phase. We don't know if theta 1-3 is non-zero. So you can use an accelerator new mu beam, like the one that's running now at Fermilab, and you can use, there's another one that was running in Japan. They're going to actually turn on a new one in a couple of years. But there are complications, and you can see why. This shows the probability that a new mu would become a new E, which is the most sensitive mode to look for a theta 1-3. And not only does this have many terms in this, but you can see that every term essentially has a theta 1-3, sine of theta 1-3 there. So if theta 1-3 is very small, all of these terms are quite tiny. You can see the delta phase here. So whenever you see a delta, we actually have no idea what that is. And so in addition, there is a matter effect here where you say A a constant times, this is the electron density times the energy. And so you get some term here that has to do with what's the electron density along the path of the neutrinos. Okay, and the reason for that is simple. When you actually have small angle scatterings of new E's on electrons, in some sense, you're projecting the wave function and making a measurement. And so you're actually changing the probability that you'll detect a new E. That's why we know that that's actually sensitive to the sign of the mixing. You notice that this one would be sensitive to the sign here of this phi 3-1.
So it's like a regeneration effect?
It's a regeneration, but much more complicated. And what this looks like graphically, it's much easier to understand graphically than it is by looking at the formula. What this says is if I do an experiment and I look at the probability that a new mu will become a new E, and I plot that percentage on this axis, and I look at the antineutrino percentage on this axis, if I increase the sine squared of 2 theta 1 3, I will make all the effects larger. I will expect, if I measure a point out here, let's say, I will make this larger and larger the larger I make theta 1 3. So it's like an amplifier. If I choose a certain CP violating phase, I get orbits that look like these ellipses, and I can move around the answer on this orbit anywhere from 0 all the way around to 2 pi. If I then look at the splitting between the signs of the mass squared differences, I split these further. And so I run into this degeneracy problem where I have only really two observables, if I got an answer here, I wouldn't know which one of these was correct. So that's why there's some reactor experiments going on right now. And so I'm going to use this chance just to show you a couple slides on something else that our group is doing that's been going on still at a somewhat lower level than what's happening in Lux, but still moving along. And that's to do a reactor experiment. And in this case, the advantage is that because there's a low energy, you only have to be 1 or 2 kilometers away, not hundreds of kilometers. And you can show that this kind of experiment where you're looking for a new E disappearance is really free of CP and matter effect uncertainty. So you can determine theta 1-3 independently. And this sort of shows what's happening here. This is the probability that a new E bar remains a new E bar. And you can see that it's really quite sensitive here to this sine squared 2 theta 1-3. So what it looks like is the probability of survival has a big one that's dominated by this delta m squared 1-2 term, and then a much smaller one that's dominated by the delta m squared 2-3, and the sort of amplitude of these little oscillations is determined by sine squared 2 theta 1-3. So we're actually right now building an experiment. It's really almost ready to turn on. This is the double show experiment that's running in France. We expect to be turning on beginning of next summer. And probably after 6 months, we'll have a very good handle on what theta 1-3 is. We'll do a lot of our initial improvement will come in the first 6 months or so. These are not big experiments that run for many, many years. These are relatively small, and they run for short periods. So it's quite an international group. This is actually a picture of the reactor. The hall is actually back here.
How often is the weather that nice?
Maybe 3 days a year. It's right in the Ardennes Forest, which is cloudy almost all the time. So this is a picture of the reactor site. The fire lab is over here. That's actually very close to being completed, and the detector is being installed right now. There's a near lab here. It's the planning is done, and they expect to start blasting on this sometime within the next 2 or 3 months.
So is the fire lab actually in Belgium? Is the
No. I guess the actually Belgian border is maybe a kilometer away on the other side. It doesn't follow the river there. So this shows a picture of the near lab. We're actually going to, this has changed a little bit now. We're actually going to go into a hill and come in from the side, but we have to actually blast out a new cavern, whereas over in the far lab, there is an existing facility, and we'll just install the detector there. And the idea is that we're going to look for that oscillation by getting detectors at two different distances. It doesn't matter if they're in a line, right? The neutrinos come out isotropically. So two different distances, that'll cancel out the cross-section and flux errors. And so just to show you a couple of pictures, this was taken just last month. This is the detector. You can see the shield is installed right here. They're getting ready to take the metal parts of the top. Let's see, a lot of the shielding design was actually done here at UC Davis for the how much shield you need, demagnetizing it, and all that sort of thing. This is a scintillator en route from Max Planck Institute. It's now being actually transported to our site. So they're very close. The pit is completed. The lab's all done. Essentially, everything's being mounted right now. The fire detector, there's only a plan. They've done all the coring that's needed. The Electricité de France will actually build this lab for us if we pay them enough money, which I guess we are. And this is what we expect to do. This is the current limit on Theta-1-3 is up around 0.19, so that's way up in the roof. And you can see that this is after we turn the fire lab on. After half a year, we actually come down quite a bit for something that's way up there. And after when we get to this blue line, about a year and a half after the start of the fire one, we'll turn on the near one, and then that's actually will go down. This change here is due to the fact that we decided to burrow into a hill rather than dig straight down. It actually takes 6 months off the schedule. So we'll get down to maybe 0.04, at least down to 0.03. So there's another reactor experiment that's being built right now in Daya Bay. And their goal is to get down less than 0.01. And right now they're digging a tunnel into the side of a mountain. And they also hope to get down to perhaps even better than 0.01. That'll be quite difficult. And they may reach there by 2012 or so is what they hope. So that's the official plot. But I guess from some of the collaborators, I hear that that's pretty unlikely they'll keep to that schedule. Yeah?
Why is that so sharp?
Because your systematics are actually quite small in these experiments. So our total systematic error will be on the order of maybe 2%. And so so when you first start, you're collecting data at a horrendous rate. And so it just drops like a rock. We expect something like 500 events a day. So
it's run there for a few days and quit.
Well, that's why people say, well, you built a 10-ton detector. Why not build 15? Well, we just sit around. We get to sit around in France for another 6 months. Is that such a bad thing? Yeah. So you don't want to make the detector too big. You have to leave quickly. So anyway, the idea is that we're going to get down to that level. They'll get down to that level pretty quickly once they start running. There's also a TDK experiment in Japan. They finished their K2K experiment. There's now a new accelerator facility in Japan called J-Park. And there's a neutrino beam that's under construction, and it says they're going to actually get the first results in 2010. They're going to turn on next year at low power and be up to full power by 2010. So they're going to send a neutrino beam from here outside of Tokyo all the way over to Kamiokande. And so then there's the experiment I'm going to talk about today. And why is this different? So there were initially two proposals. One was to have a neutrino beam going from Brookhaven all the way out to Homestake, then another one from Fermilab. And I think this one is actually not going to happen now. There's just not a lot of interest to do that at Brookhaven. This is the one I'm going to talk about. It's 1,300 kilometers, and sort of the design is about 300 kilotons of water Cherenkov, though that's certainly not locked in. So the Deep Underground Science and Engineering Lab. This shows the sort of, I guess it's supposed to be the Empire State Building, so you're about, how many, 6.5 Empire State Buildings down. Shows the lab going down here. This is the, let's see if I can find where I'm at here. This is the shaft here, geoscience. Okay, so this little area that's shown over here, it's not shown in this map, it's where the LEX experiment's going to be. But there's a plan to actually put some very large experiments over in this area. Same level, slightly different off. So why would you do that? Well, the answer is pretty simple. 1,300 kilometer distance is significant for determining the mass hierarchy. Basically, it's just more dirt. So if you look at what you get from 800 kilometers, this is the probability of oscillation. This is 0.09 up here. This is the neutrino energy. And you can see the normal and inverted hierarchies. If you look at an 800 kilometer distance, and you look at the true neutrino energy, and remember the cross-section is going down roughly linear with energy, that if you're looking in this area, you simply don't get very much oscillation when you go out to the energies where you're high enough to get a big cross-section. And so by being far away, you get this huge difference between the two hierarchies as compared to the small one and a much lower cross-section. So this just shows for infinite statistics. In reality, it's better than that because you get much better statistics.
So Brookhaven wouldn't have even been any better?
Brookhaven is better, but not that much better.
Okay. You just don't have
it. Well, it's falling off as 1 over r squared. You're getting back 1 over... Well, it's falling 1 over e squared. How does it say this? Falling off at 1 over r squared, you're gaining back by e, linear with e, and you gain back by detector size. So if you went to Brookhaven, you could make it up by going to higher energy or a bigger detector. But you wouldn't, in the end, you don't do that much better. And I want to show you that that's well matched to what we will know about theta 1-3. If I tried to do better, well, there'd be too much ambiguity. I wouldn't be able to separate out the answers. So we've been looking at a water Cherenkov detector. And so... that's not me there. I believe that's Steve Aretti, who's at the University of Illinois now. That's the old IMB detector built in Cleveland. That was actually my graduate student thesis project. There's the Kamiokande detector built a little bit later, 1 kiloton. This is 3 kilotons. Super Kamiokande, 22 kilotons. So what we're talking about is something larger, perhaps 3 modules, each of 100 kilotons. And this little thing over here is where the Lux experiment would be. In fact, it would not be, it would be like 1 pixel on this experiment, on this plot. So that's what we're talking about. There was a report from the so-called Neutrino Scientific Advisory Group that actually looked at various options for this kind of experiment. This is a sort of NUMMI medium energy. This means 0.9 degrees off axis. I don't want to go into that too much. With a 100 kiloton liquid argon experiment. And they went through a lot of different variations of this. And what they ended up recommending at the end was essentially a 300 kiloton water experiment or a 100 kiloton liquid argon experiment would be roughly similar in sensitivity. And so there's groups that are working on water Cherenkov and there are groups that are working on liquid argon. But water Cherenkov is clearly much more advanced in technology. But a lot of people are still interested in liquid argon for various reasons. I'll show you.
They call that similar factor 3 better?
Well, this is a hard plot to read. This shows...
In the bottom 2, 3, and 4, the argon looks much better?
It is. It is for some things.
I see.
You have to look at... This is 100 kiloton liquid argon. It's 300 kilotons water. This shows that it's a factor 2 better resolution for theta 1-3. This shows for CP violation, this is much better. This is 0.035. This means for 5 sigma, for 5 sigma determination, 50% of all CP angles. You obviously can't do them all because if there's 0 CP violation, you can never get that exactly. And so the criteria is 5 sigma determinations for 50% of possibilities. This you'd need sine squared 2 theta greater than 0.1. This is 0.03. So and this
argon,
says.
So argon has issues. I mean, water you know how to do.
Yeah.
Is argon in the same state? Like
no, it's not. I have some slides on the R&D issues. It's not in the same state. But I guess the main point of this slide is it's better. But this is not the... This is how big how small theta 1-3 could be and get this result. It's a hard plot to read.
Okay.
Yeah, so this being large is worse because that's what you need to get that level of sensitivity. So if I want to determine the sine of delta M squared 1-3 at 5 sigma for any value of this delta CP, that's the sine squared 2 theta 1-3 I need. So notice on here that there's only in one spot that it actually says anything that's less than 0.01. So the reason I said that double show is good enough and that is because none of these things you really need to do much better than that. So we'll get the first liquid double show, and then Diabe and TDK will come in. And they want to go down to 0.01, and you really don't need to do much better than that. And I have to say that the main point is not to measure theta 1-3. I think that's, I don't think a lot of people, I shouldn't say a lot, some people are interested in theta 1-3. I personally am more interested in whether or not neutrinos are violating CP than I am in the value of the matrix element. I also like to know the ordering of the masses. So, let me just... we've started looking at what you could do with a... We were asked to It may be that you have to build these things in threes because you can't make a cavern that big. That's not for sure, but we think that might be the case. And so we started looking at initially a 100 kiloton water detector and what you could do versus measurement of sine squared theta 1-3 for two different mass hierarchies. So you can get out to about 0.02, which is not bad, but not that much better than NOVA would do. And so this tells you, mass hierarchy. This tells you the mass hierarchies you'll get versus sine squared theta 1-3. This is the interesting one. This shows you determination of CP phase. If the CP true value is here, this shows you how well you can do at 1 sigma and 95% confidence level. And then happens to be for normal hierarchy versus what the value of sine squared 2 theta 1 3 is. And so you can see it's a very convoluted kind of measurement, but you can extract the CP phase if theta 1 3 is big enough, greater than about 0.05 or something.
And there's no ambiguity, right? It's just.
Yeah, in this case, there's not. So it really depends. If theta 1-3 really determines a lot. So what would Fermilab have to do to actually make such a beam? That's something that's not in my exact area of expertise, but we have people in the collaboration who are experts at that. So we know that there's two possibilities that are being considered and some small variations on those. Whether or not we want to have 60 GeV protons or 120 GeV protons. And then there's the question of, do you want to actually have the beam point right at your detector or point slightly off axis? The reason you like to be slightly off axis is because that actually makes your neutrino beam energy a narrower band, it turns out. The kinematics, actually, if you move off, you get a much tighter range of neutrino energies, and that turns out to be good. You'd like it to be tighter, but not too tight. These curves show the oscillations that you would expect for various values of the CP violating parameter. Okay, versus the unoscillated flux. This is the probability of oscillations that you would apply to that and multiply. So there's still some question as to which would be the best energy, and there's quite a number of people working on that. So what do you have to do? We want the maximum possible neutrino fluxes to get at least the first and second oscillation nodes. The trick of these experiments is that instead of seeing one, you try to get in two. Seeing two actually really constrains things much better than just seeing a single oscillation. It's like having two detectors, okay, if you see both oscillations in one detector. And so larger fluxes at lower energies are desirable. For in this experiment, you would rather have huge flux at low energy than a small flux at higher energy. So that's why this so-called intensity frontier that they came up with, saying the buzzword. The big background that you're going to run into is nu mu going to nu e is the neutral current flux. At the higher neutrino energies greater than 5 GeV, you get actually substantial contribution from single pi zero production by neutral current, and that can look like a nu e interaction in your detector. So we have to worry about that. And there's also an irreducible nu e to nu mu to nu e background from kaon to kaon the beam, which has a branching ratio to nu e. So, for those of you who are familiar with the Fermilab site, what would this do to your parking? Well, so here's the let me get myself. Here's the actual existing Numi Minos beam along here, and Homestake is actually coming off this way. So here's the high rise here, and you come off actually back of the high rise and go back this way, and you come out not too far from the Kirk Road exit. That's where the plan is for the neutrino beam.
What's that going to do to the buffalo?
Well, they're toast.
They're toast.
I don't know. So this thing will also have to be underground, just like the beam that we had for. It shows you 5.84 degrees. 400 meters. We may actually need 400 meters. It turns out it's much shorter than the NUMI beam line. Perhaps can be even shorter than that. The NUMI beam line was too long, basically, for what they thought they were going to need. Remember, when they did that, they thought delta M squared was very high. And it turned out it was lower by the time they finished. And so they ran at low energy. They didn't need such a long decay length. So there's a lot of waste there. So, but you'll still be 500 feet underground by the time you reach to the end.
The waste because you're building?
You're going deeper and farther than you need to.
Right. That's point at 500 feet is still on site?
It is. Yeah. It is. So the event rates, I'm not going to go through this because it's pretty complicated, but just to show you that this shows the new mutant-new-E rates and the anti-neutrino rates for a given. This shows the number of events you would expect for this number per kiloton, per megawatt, per 10 to the 7 seconds, the units of beam luminosity. What you would get in, let's see, does it say? I believe this is for the 300 kiloton, but I guess it doesn't say here.
400 kiloton.
Where's that?
Per
100 kiloton, that's right. That's right. This is per 100 kiloton. Okay, so you see that the main thing is we're looking at variations on the something on the order of 100 events with variations anywhere from about 10 to 100. So this is not a high statistics experiment. You really have to be quite efficient and rely on knowing the beam very well. So there would have to be a near detector that was fairly fine-grained. And we've talked about having a liquid argon one for that. So anyway, that's the idea. And in addition to doing that, of course, there's a lot of other things you can do. And we were told, for instance, by that the NSF and the DOE wanted to see an experiment that could, quote, do good physics from day one, even if the neutrino beam weren't ready for a couple of years after the detector was ready. So I'm gonna talk a little bit about nucleon decay. This is 300 kilotons is 13 times the size of super K. Galactic supernova at 10 kiloparsecs, we get almost 25,000 events. Remember, the last one that happened in 87A, we got about a dozen events or so. So that would be a huge improvement. Relic supernovae, there's actually going to be a... I guess, no, we aren't going to talk about that. The person couldn't come. There's a 100 kiloton water churn cup detector. Dope with gadolinium should see roughly... should see these, according to most theories. 40% of these come from supernovas with Z greater than 0.5, so you're really probing dark energy kind of distances when you look at this, and stellar formation at those distances. Then if you're interested, you can actually look for the so-called HEP, which does not stand for high energy physics. It can stand for, helium electron proton triple interactions in the sun, which are predicted but have never been seen. Hydrogen electron proton. So, nucleon decay, that's a pretty old topic. It's been around for a long time. The idea is that if I have a baryon, like a proton or neutron, I may be able to emit something that goes under the sort of generic name of leptoquark, and protons or neutrons could decay, okay, and basically violate baryon number. That's the idea. And this is predicted by many theories. Has a lot of connections to basic theories of baryon number, lepton number, so-called the guts and the supersymmetric guts. All those predict proton decay at some level. So a lot of people, you probably haven't, if you remember this from the 1990s, you probably haven't looked at this in many years. So this is sort of a little review. We know that if you look at the running coupling constants for the weak, strong, and the electromagnetic coupling constants, we know in the standard model these do not come together at one point. But if you do something slick like add minimal supersymmetry, you can make these come pretty close together at high energies. And so that's convinced people that they had to follow through with this and try to look at models in which this happens, and then these proton baryon non-conserving reactions can take place. The sort of standard one that we've all seen over the years has been, say proton goes to E plus pi zero. That was a famous one, the one that I worked on my graduate thesis for. And the prediction from SU5 was 10 to the 29 with this error years, and it made us very enthusiastic when we were graduate students, because we designed an experiment that could get up to about 10 to the 30. So the current branch, the limit on this is about almost 10 to 34 years now from super K. So this is way ruled out. Just no way. There's also, if you say that there's SUSY, you can imagine that there might be, Wienos or Higgsinos. And these could mediate in many different ways nucleon decay. A favorite mode is K plus nu. And these predictions fall in a much larger range because of much larger uncertainty. And this is the current limit from super K, about 2 times 10 to the 32.
their actual K-on identification point on Super K?
Yeah. This one? Sort of a, well, I'll show you. Okay. So there are still lots of people worried about this. And I'm taking a guess that if I ask people would they rather know what the value of theta 1,3 is or if protons decay, virtually everybody in this room would rather know if protons decay. So what does it look like in Super K? So this shows an event which is a proton goes to mu plus pi 0. Guess what? It's a Monte Carlo event. Yeah, it must be. So what happens is the pi 0 immediately makes two gammas and makes two sort of fuzzy Cherenkov rings here. And then there's a muon ring from the Cherenkov light that's quite sharp. And here the actual color indicates timing. We can get timing to a nanosecond over the whole detector. And so we can actually reproduce, we can actually fit the vertex, fit the pi zero invariant mass, and get all, essentially kinematically constrain this entire event. So we require fully contained, we can take two or three rings. Third ring might come because if you sing a muon, it will certainly decay. And sometimes it actually decays in the first time scale and you see a third ring. Sometimes it appears in the next event. So, but anyway, we can actually do quite a good job for looking for events like this. And if I look at Super K, for instance, and a Monte Carlo, and look at the invariant mass that you can reconstruct in the Monte Carlo versus the total momentum, then all the events we're looking for nicely fit in a little box. The backgrounds that we fit from the neutrino Monte Carlos are low. This is the actual data. There are no candidates there. So, and that shows another version of Super K. I won't go through that. But you expect about 0.2 events per 100 kiloton year in background. But no one's ever seen a background event in all these years. So no one's ever seen an event that looked like a E plus pi zero.
How many kiloton years have Super K?
About 130 kiloton years now.
That's a 0.3.
They should see one, but don't yet. That's right. So what about proton decays to K plus neutrino? Well, the K plus is below the Cherenkov threshold. That's the problem. So when you get the K plus to decay, it can go to neutrino mu plus. And so all you see is a single mu plus. Well, you see a dozen of those every day just from the atmospheric neutrinos. That's a problem. And so you can do other things like look for the K ion goes to pi plus pi zero. But the problem is that this pi plus actually has very little energy and it's just barely above Cherenkov threshold. And the thing that you'd like to look for most, and this does not really show the right thing, is that you look for a K ion and a mu plus, but the residual nucleus that's left behind will actually emit a gamma with about 50% probability, according to the nuclear theory. No one's actually ever measured that. So this so-called precursor gamma is a way to tag these. And so you actually look for this gamma from the de-excitation of nitrogen 15. To do that requires a lot of phototube coverage. So what's the bottom line? If you were to make a much larger detector, let's say starting in 2017, which I hate to say would be the start date at the earliest of such a detector. So I'm not worrying about overlapping with Lux or with Double Show very much. By the time this started, those experiments would be long over. But this is a log plot, and you might get up to around 10 to the 35 years for E plus pi zero. For this is where you see the big difference between water Cherenkov and liquid argon. If you believe that supersymmetry is correct, then a large liquid argon detector would actually get way up into the region that you might expect to see proton decay, depending on what the parameters of supersymmetry were. So I'm going to quickly go through the rest. The other thing we can look for is these relic supernovae. So supernovae are happening every day all over the whole universe. And they're making a background of neutrino events, sometimes called relic neutrinos, but that's not really correct. People now like to call it diffuse supernova flux. If I look at the neutrino energy, then you can see that typically this is at Kamioka. You'll see that the supernova flux in red actually has a window of opportunity right here between the atmospheric neutrinos and the hep-solar neutrinos and the reactor neutrinos at Kamioka. It's actually better at home state because this big curve here is gone. There are no reactor neutrinos. This purple curve, rather.
What's the star?
That's just, I think it's just the supernova flux, neutrino flux.
Why is that? There are no reactors.
So you're summing over all the explosions.
Right.
This is phi sub-explosion.
Why are there no reactors?
There's no reactors. There's nothing around there, right? Homestake, it's nothing. There's just a bunch of Harleys.
Because nuclear power is bad.
They just don't need that much power.
Nice.
So what could you do? Well, this shows the... right now, if you look at the direct core collapse measurements and look at the supernova rate per year per cubic megaparsec, from the direct measurements, go out to about 0.3 or so. So the nice thing about the relic supernovae is that this is one model in which the integrated, in which the stellar formation rate actually looks like this. And with the integrated supernova, with this diffuse relic supernova flux, you can actually get information on these that take place out here. About 40% of the neutrinos come from this part of the diagram where there aren't any data points. And so typically in Super K, you can look for these, and they would appear in this window, but there's lots of background from these below Cherenkov threshold muons and from atmospheric nu E. And so actually, one of the things I'm doing at Livermore is developing these gadolinium detectors that would ever actually be able to throw these events away. So that would improve greatly the sensitivity of the water Cherenkov detectors for this. So where are you? Well, there are many people who have calculated the relic flux and shown on this scale a log plot. These are the various calculations that have been done. I won't go through them in detail. This is the current super K limit, but you can see a factor of 10 to 13 would be a great improvement. We'd actually take into account all the models. If we didn't see them, that would be a big deal because they should be there, unless the universe is very different than what we think.
Do you have directional accuracy?
No, not at all. No, not really. If we saw thousands, we would, but we expect tens. That's the problem. In a real big supernova, we would have some directionality. So there's water Cherenkov R&D issues. There's a number of them, none of them too serious. One of the biggest ones is how to keep the phototubes from imploding and destroying the detector. That's clearly a big issue. And so there are people at Brookhaven and people at Orsay working on putting these phototubes into tanks and improving the thickness of the glass and where do you add the thickness of the glass and how do you actually make these things operate at lower. What's the PMT coverage required for detection of the precursor gamma from this proton decay? We know that 20% coverage in SK2 was too little. Didn't work. Okay, a lot of other ones. I won't go through this. We have to know how to make cheap phototubes. Do we need a veto region? How do you build such a large cavern? As Monty said, I was on a talk where I gave a talk on geology, so which is amazing. I never thought I would give a talk on that. Geotechnical work. Can the efficiency for electron and pion separation be improved? So the liquid argon program, this is actually going at Fermilab. There are little TPCs running. There are a number of people at Fermilab working on that. I guess Argo Newt was in the Symmetry magazine a while back. They're actually developing this. They hope to go to build up to a larger and larger detectors. This is also part of our collaboration. We're really sort of a mixture of people. At some point in the future, we'll make a technology decision, but with a start date of 2017 or 2018, you don't have to make decisions like that right away. So there's a lot of issues here, as Monty probably knows, or people who worked with cryogenics. How do you insulate this thing? This thing is the size of this building. Can you actually put liquid argon in it without pumping it down to vacuum? Right? That's going to be a really hard problem. Underground safety, the cost is sort of astronomical right now.
They have to get the argon 1 mile underground, first of all.
Yeah, and to keep it from killing everybody underground, too, if it leaks out. So there is a new collaboration, which is quite large right now. These are all the people who have signed up. A lot of people from Fermilab and Brookhaven. We're having our first meeting, official meeting of the big group, next week at Brookhaven. So right now... the project is, I guess the three main people on this project are Milan Diwan at Brookhaven and myself here at Davis are the interim co-leaders of the project. And then Ed Luker in Chicago is the executive committee chair. So the three of us are sort of running this until we have a formal collaboration. And at that point, we'll either be kicked out or continue to run this thing. So a lot of folks. This is the, I guess, now Davis has a leg in each one of these circles, I guess. This is the basically saying the those of us who follow these sorts of things in the DOE have seen this in the NSF. This is so-called energy frontier. This would be pushing to the highest energies you can get. This would be work at the LHC. This is so-called cosmic frontier. This is looking at dark energy and dark matter. That's like LSST and Lux and the other things that we're doing. And this over here is the so-called intensity frontier. And that's where this project at Fermilab and Dussel sits. And at least in this report, it pictures those as being sort of three parts of the U.S. program for the next decade. And that's it.
Other questions for Bob?
I have a quick one. What's this going to cost?
We put together initial costs for the water Cherenkov, and we got... for the cavern itself was about $85 million, and the estimate for the electronics and everything else was about $100 million. So about $185 million for the first module.
One out of three.
But it's you gain by, after you do the first one, you have to buy a whole bunch of mining equipment. After you've done that, you don't have to buy it again. And so all three of them would be done for about $500 million. So the plan is actually to do this inside the current DOE budget without having to get a big increase. The NSF would kick in the cavern, which is about, the laboratory is about, the laboratory is about $250 million. So the cavern itself would be an addition to that. The NSF might pay for that. And then the rest of the detectors would be $500 million over, say, a decade. And so that clearly fits well into the DOE budget as it stands. In other words, we don't have to ask Congress for whopping increase to build a big machine.
1,000 will be left.
Yeah.
Many be left.
That's true. Think of those terms. It's nothing.
Are there actually any benefits of building three as opposed to one gigantic, other than a lot easier to build? Are there any physics benefits?
The one benefit is this. If we're not ready to build a liquid argon one, you could think about building the water one. Doing the neutrino beam experiment, and pretty much the 100 kilotons gets you most of what you need from the neutrino beam. And then you may be, by that time, LHC may have results, and your interest may turn much more intensely to looking at supersymmetric proton decay. It may become a big issue. So holding off, spending all your money on one technology may be an advantage. And wait till the other ones develop and see what happens at the LHC also.
How do you, right now, determine pions and kaons in water
shrink detectors? You can, because the actual angle actually depends upon beta. And so if it's going slow enough, you can actually measure the opening angle. And that'll tell you the energy of the particle versus the... tells you the momentum versus the total deposited energy, which is proportional to the light. And so you can actually do particle ID. The other thing you can do is if the kaon is above Cherenkov threshold, you'll see a kaon ring. And then you'll see a muon ring and then an electron ring as the muon decays. You'll see those three tracks. So you can track it. In super K, the tracks are good to about, at those energies, probably about 10 to 15 centimeter tracking, which is pretty good over a detector that's 40 meters wide.
How do you align the neutrino beam to the detector from Fermilab?
It can be done with GPS.
Yes.
You don't have to do anything. Nope, you could hit it. I was amazed. Back in the early 90s, I was on the first team for Fermilab in 91 that looked into whether you could do that, and GPS was pretty new. And to our amazement, even in 91, you could actually aim something from Fermilab to Minnesota and hit it within like 6 centimeters. It was amazing.
How wide is the actual beam when it arrives?
It's about 2 kilometers wide. Okay. So you don't have to hit it that close. You won't see any variation of the detector even.
Does the these neutrinos come originally from the main injector, is that right? That's the NUMMI?
The NUMMI beams comes from the main injector. Right now, what they'd like to do is replace the current booster and then beef that up and make go from about 350 kilowatts where they are now to about 700 kilowatts. And then if and that's enough, the plots I showed you mostly were for the 700 kilowatts. If they decide to do Project X and build the segment of the ILC and use that, it would go up to about 2.3 megawatts. And so obviously you're going to gain. But so the experiment doesn't rely upon Project X, but it would be much better if Project X happened.
So you don't have to do anything to the main injector, you just have improvements to the booster.
Yeah,
so when you were running this, that's it? Fermilab can't do anything else?
That's pretty much it, yeah.
Wow. So you assume NUMMI and all is finished, MIMO is finished by
then? Those will all be done.
And there's no fixed target, nothing
like The only thing, there's the other projects that are online are there's a muon to electron direct conversion, and that's probably going to run before this. There's also there's a NOVA project, but it's not clear whether NOVA is going to go ahead or not. They're sort of teetering on the edge. And actually, if you look at it, one of the people on our experiment is the co-spokesman of NOVA. So, Mark
so,
Messier.
So they think they can keep all of Fermilab busy doing this? That's 3,000 people over there.
Well, making his beam is a non-trivial thing.
Okay.
It's not clear they have enough people. They are talking about combining
so
resources.
So you talk about the cost of your project. That plus Fermilab.
Yes, you need Fermilab.
Wow. Yes.
But what we're being told is that this is the... They want to do this experiment. They said what they gave us, the parameters, were don't think of whether we have these materials or not. Think of what you need, and we'll get what you need for you. If we have to go to Brookhaven or KEK and get the people to do this, we'll do that. So that's what we're being told. The NSF and DOE are expected to sign an MOU on this by December.
So this is DOE and NSF that are saying that?
Yes. Yeah. And the DOE has told us they'd like us to go through CD0 this December and CD1 by next December. So, which is pretty aggressive.
Yeah.
So, this is going to be, this will be a large project, which goes well beyond those physicists that I listed on that slide. There's lots of people involved. And the actual collaboration, I've seen these big organizational trees, the actual collaboration of physicists is down here somewhere, and there's this huge DOE NSF organization up here. So that's the way it works.
Everybody has a seat.
Yeah, so all the bodies are down here, but most of the people are up here. Well, I guess all lab staff is in these other places.
Right.
But no, it would be the main project of Fermilab. I mean, this would be it for the next 10 years.
What happens after CD1?
After CD1, that basically tells you you have to have made a technology choice that you've decided whether or not you're going to wait for liquid argon or make your first module water Cherenkov. You basically have to have decided on the first module what you're going to do for CD1. CD0, you just have to approve that there's a scientific need, which I think will go along. That will be pretty easy.
Can you make a liquid argon decision? Year and a half from now, that's what you were saying for your timeline.
Well, you'll get different things from different people, but my personal opinion is you can make it, and that decision will be negative. Because they won't be ready.
Right.
You won't be able to, there's too much risk involved. And so, but I like the idea of building the first module, and I'm actually pushing to have two modules of 150 kilotons each. Building the first module, which is enough to do all the neutrino physics, pretty much do what you need to do for the supernova relic neutrinos, and won't do as well as you'd like to do in proton decay. And so then you wait for the liquid argon, and if LHC is a big success and supersymmetry is seen, then you may actually decide to... I mean, the first estimate for a 30-kiloton liquid argon detector was $100 million, but that has big error bars. The numbers I gave you for water Cherenkov probably have 25% error bars. Those are from engineers.
What is the theoretical error bar on the diffuse, what do you want to call it, relic neutrinos?
I said it's about a factor of 8. And about half of that is due to uncertainties in the supernova mechanism. About half of that's due to uncertainties in the stellar formation rate as a function of redshift.
Okay.
So that determines the.
So your first round is just it's not going to yield anything besides nailing down the model. Maybe.
If you should be able to nail down the model. We'll see anywhere between 20 to 200, depending on what the model is. So that's what you'll get. And this gadolinium idea has to work. So.
So once you nail down the model, what's the real goal of measurement there? You still have a dark energy, so.
Well, the idea is to look at what the stellar formation rate was at large redshifts. Are stars being formed the way you think they're being formed? Are the number of super... If we saw many, many fewer than we expected to see, we'd have to say that the stellar formation rate must have been much lower. So conditions in that I'd say Z equals 0.6, 0.7, must be very different than what we think they are. And I think that has to put some uncertainty in the supernova measurements. If we see bang on what we expect, that takes another source of uncertainty out of the dark energy.
And will LSST have removed some of this uncertainty?
That I don't know how it compares. This is a completely different way.
Yeah.
But this is completely independent of all the optical observations. And so if they agree, then you can be pretty certain that this is correct. So it's pretty unambiguous, too. I mean, if you see the signal, it may be quite large.
Other questions?
I wouldn't recommend that graduate students take this on as their thesis just yet.
Graduate in 2020?
Yeah, right, graduate 2020 or so.
It's been done before. did you give us the physics case for the liquid argon technology?
The main physics case is that you can do about a factor of, if you had the same amount of each, you can do about a factor of three better. But the cost is more. One thing you can't really make up is the proton goes to neutrino kaon, proton decay mode. The super K is very inefficient for that. Even with a precursor gamma, just drawing my memory, the total efficiency is about 15%, whereas liquid argon are pretty more like 80, 85%. So you're going to gain a good factor of five just in efficiency. And there's no background because now you're seeing it's a monoenergetic kaon followed by a monoenergetic muon, followed by a Michell electron, and there just won't be any background. So even a couple events would be really golden.
And this is the proton and the oxygen has to decay for this.
That's where you get a lot of your signal. You could, if you're lucky, you could get a free proton decay. But in liquid argon, it's going to be an argon. Right?
Yeah, but if a free proton decays, then there is what happens to that electron that was in the hydrogen.
Oh, no, but free proton decay, you should get. A neutrino, antineutrino, and a K plus, right? And then the K plus goes to B plus nu.
But there's no gamma in this case,
right? The gamma actually comes from the fact that you ripped a proton out of a oxygen nucleus. So instead of being oxygen 16, it's now hydrogen 15, excited state.
Not oxygen, then this is hydrogen.
Right? Yeah, then you won't see the precursor gamma. That's correct. You're right.
I see.
In this case, you won't see it. There won't be any gamma. So. But you have eight protons in oxygen and two in,
sure, yeah.
So you're just playing the odds.
Yeah.
That's taken into account in the limit, of course. You won't see it. So in argon, I'm not sure if they'd see it.
Lifetime is different inside oxygen than.
Well, the thing that worries me is that this gamma is really theoretical. It's never really been seen experimentally. It's hard to make experiments to see it, and so there are very few things you can do to simply make a proton disappear inside of a nucleus. I mean, the kaon doesn't really interact coming out. The neutrino certainly doesn't. So you have the best thing you can do is send in a neutron and try to do some sort of knockout reaction. But then you have a neutron involved, right? So things are different.
It's not the same.
So it's theoretical. If you did see it, that would be a good tag. But not seeing it, there's always the question of is that's a good way to reject events.
Roughly what temperature does argon have to be liquid?
Oh boy, I forget. Minus 100 centigrade or something like that. It's not outrageous. Okay. It's not like liquid helium or something like that. It's like minus 100, minus 150. I don't remember.
So you can use
that
as liquid
nitrogen
can
distill it.
Okay. So it's not nothing outrageous.
Yeah.
You can use nitrogen to liquefy argon.
If you notice on that slide, there's a lot of groups from Italy also working on the liquid nitrogen. So I guess there. I think soon there will be a worldwide collaboration because we've been meeting with the Europeans and the Japanese. And there's a lot of emphasis to move towards a very large collaboration of Asia, Europe, and the U.S. So, fortunately, we'll probably pick up some expertise. The people in Europe have been working on this for a long time. But due to the cost of the LHC, they have no money for a neutrino beam.
All right, let's thank Bob again.
Thank you.